time. We know, and we both feel terrible about it, but we'll have him with us on the way home. They let you off down by the airport? Yeah, nice guys. I mean, we aren't peacekeepers, but we're all working for the people anyway, right? That's not by the book. You know, I thought that very thing and really appreciated it that he wasn't one of those hard guys that gives the working man a bad time. Well, I don't want to make your life miserable either, sir, so we can make this real easy. How about you two just show me your marks of loyalty and you can move it along? Chloe thought Mac had nearly talked his way out of the situation, but if he was no threat, showing his mark wouldn't have been a problem. "Don't hesitate, Hannah," Chloe said. "I wish that other guy would get out of his car." From the walkie-talkie, "You just want to see our marks?" "Yes, sir. Hand or forehead?" "Mine's on the forehead here, under the cap. My partner's is, where is yours, bud?" "Hand," Sebastian said. "Let's have a look," the peacekeeper said. "Where's yours, by the way?" Max said. "You got the image of the potentate, too?" "Nah, just the number. I'm kind of military that way." Chloe glanced at Hannah, then back at the truck where Max slowly unlatched his seatbelt and took off his cap. He leaned forward. "I don't see anything." "What? Look!" From the walkie-talkie, George, in a quiet sing-song, "Now would be the perfect time." The peacekeeper spun in a circle, slammed back against the cab of the truck, and dropped, screaming. As he slowly started to rise, Max said, "Say there, fella, what was that all about?" "I don't know, fire ants or something." He rubbed his back gingerly, now standing. He motioned to the officer in the other GC car, who quickly stepped out. "What's the trouble?" "Pain in my back, like I backed into a hot pipe or something. I think a blister's rising." He leaned toward Mac again, then grabbed the back of his leg and howled, falling and writhing. The other officer drew his weapon. "What are you guys doing?" "We're not doing anything," Mac said. "What's his problem?" The inside light of the truck came on, and George got out and went toward the front with his hands raised. He must have had the walkie-talkie in his pocket now, because Chloe could still hear him on Hannah's radio. "Can I help in any way?" he asked. "Stay right where you are," the second peacekeeper said, just before he flopped in the road, dropping his weapon and trying to cover his face. Mac jumped out to help George. "Yank the radios in their cars," he said. "I'll get the ones on their uniforms." By now, the officers were delirious, glassy-eyed, and wailing. "Ladies," George radioed, "come help us with these cars." Mac disarmed the officers and tossed their weapons into the bed of the truck. He took their radios and put them in the front seat. "Once you've got those car radios disconnected," he told George, "pop the trunks." Chloe and Hannah came running. "Chloe," Mac said, "you two are going to give us an escort. Once I get this guy in the trunk of his car, I'll pull the truck in behind you. Hannah, you fall in behind once we get the other guy in his trunk." The GC were whimpering. "You boys hush now," Mac said. "You're going to hurt a while, but you're not going to die unless you make us shoot you. We're just going for a little ride." With the GC ensconced in their respective trunks, Mac carefully turned the truck around and told George to give the women extra ammo from the bag they had gotten at the co-op. With the truck and the two GC squad cars pointed west, one of the GC radios crackled. "North roadblock, acknowledge, please." "North roadblock," Mac said, while only half mashing the transmit button. "Repeat." "North roadblock here," he said, careful to make sure he was heard, but not perfectly. "Status?" "Busy. Carry on." George hopped back into the truck, and as Chloe pulled away and Mac followed, George said, "Looky here. I knew there was something about that old gal I really liked." In amongst the ammunition, Mrs. P. had had co-op people pack bread, cheese, and fruit. "Chloe and Hannah took most of it," George said. "And I'm gonna take most of what's left unless you grab now." Mac grabbed, and the unlikely convoy rolled west into the night toward their ride home. How long the ruse would hold was the mystery. For now, Mac enjoyed the food and the hope that they had beaten the odds. Chapter 11. The report from Mac allowed Chang to breathe easier for the first time in hours. He checked back into Carpathia's office where Akbar was debriefing the big boss. "We've had a setback, but there's no way this bunch can..." "A setback?" "Without going into all the details, sir, the hostage killed one of our people, a woman, and has escaped. We assume he's on the run with the three who..." "He killed one of his captors?" "Yes, Highness, we assume..." "My kind of a man. Why cannot he be on our side?" "We assume, sir, that he is reconnecting with the three who came for him, and we're hoping they will be foolish enough to try to get back to the airport. We have that sealed tight." "Yes, well..." Carpathia sounded distracted, as if the rest of the story was not as interesting. "Suhail, how was damage control today?"
"Too early to tell, sir."
"Come, come, I count on you as one who does not try to simply appease me. They heard the pilot's report, and my telling them he was mistaken, that the bombs had missed their targets. Well, what are people saying?"
"I honestly don't know, Excellency. I have spent my entire day between your office and my own trying to ride herd on this grease thing.
Let me tell you this, Suhail. The disc from the plane clearly shows direct hits and those traitors burning. Whatever is the magic that allows those people to survive simply cannot extend outside that area.
Begging your pardon, but not that long ago we lost ground troops outside."
"I know that, Suhail! Do you think I do not know that?" "Apologies, Potentate. I want us to find the safe place surrounding that area, where we have not seen our weapons of war swallowed up by the earth, and from which we can stop all traffic in and out. They will need supplies, and we must see that they do not get them."
"Our armed forces have been so decimated, sir.
Are you telling me we have no pilots or planes that can cut off supplies to Petra?"
"No, sir. I'm sure we can do that. On another matter, sir, our ancient text experts say that the next curse could be that the lakes and rivers of the world fall into the same predicament as the seas.
Fresh water sources all turn to blood?"
"Yes, sir."
"Impossible! Everyone would die, even our enemies."
"There are those who believe the Judites will be protected, as they have been against our forces recently."
"Where will they get their water?"
"The same place they got their protection. Perhaps there is wisdom in negotiating with their leader to have the curses lifted."
"Never!"
"Not to be contrary, sir, but we cannot survive long with this devastation, and if the rivers and lakes do also turn..."
"You are not aware of everything, Suhail. I, too, have supernatural power."
"I have seen it, sir. You will see more.
Reverend Fortunato is prepared to match the wizardry of the Judites blow for blow, and he has designates who can do this around the world."
"Well, that..."
"Now show me what I want to see, Suhail."
"North Roadblock, this is Central."
"Roadblock," Mac said.
"Go ahead, Central."
"Disposition of suspicious truck."
"Repeat."
"One of our squads reported that your first stop after they passed was a truck."
"Affirmative. Clean."
"Traveling west to east?"
"Affirmative."
"We traced a cell phone to the west side of the city and then east before losing it."
Mac looked at George.
"What do they want to hear?"
"You know nothing about that," Mac transmitted.
"Can't help you there."
"Truck proceeded east?"
"Roger that."
"You reported lots of traffic."
10-4.
"Busy?"
"Affirmative.
Squad said they saw nothing but the truck when they passed."
"Busy now."
"What's your 10-20 roadblock?"
Mac looked at George again.
"They're on to us."
George pulled the weapons from beneath the seat and Rayford's walkie-talkie from his pocket.
"Jinnah, Irene, be advised. We'll soon have company."
Mac clicked the GC radio button a few times.
"Repeat," he said. "Your 10-20 roadblock, what's your location?"
Chang froze. He had been nearly dozing, listening to Carpathia and Akbar's sparring while they watched reports from the United North American States and the United South American States. He hadn't kept up with the Ptolemaeus Project. The local GC had traced Elena's cell phone to the west side of the city, and it had remained in one location for more than an hour. Commander Nelson Stefanich and the survivors of the Philosopher team were personally leading the raid on a pub in that area. He phoned Mac.
Talk fast, Chang. We may be in deep weeds here.
How far west of the city are you?
Not sure. I've had this thing floored, but I don't think it goes faster than 50.
They chasing us?
Are you too far from the co-op to help them?
Depends. What's up?
GC's raiding the pub right now. You know the next thing to go will be the co-op.
Any chance they got out?
Can't imagine. I couldn't warn them.
I'm guessing we're less than 30 minutes from our plane. We'll go back if you think we can help.
Hang on. A report's coming through. Judite underground discovered beneath pub. Firefight. 16 GC dead and another dozen injured. Building grenaded and torched. Several adjacent buildings destroyed. No enemy survivors.
While Mac filled in George, the GC continued to try to reach Mac on the radio, asking for some kind of a code.
We've blocked off both ends of the North Road due to the raid, so wrap it up, they said. Still need your all-clear code.
George looked devastated and tried to grab the GC radio from Mac.
I'll give him an all-clear code.
Take it easy, friend.
It was my fault, Mac. What was I thinking hanging on to that phone?
I wish we could have gone back, Mac said. I'd like to have taken out a few of them myself, but our brothers and sisters are in heaven, and it sounds like they put up some kind of a fight.
That's it, George said. We're supposed to feel good because I got a bunch of people killed and now they're in heaven.
Need the all-clear code now, the radio said.
I had to tell them that it's Psalm 94:1, Mac said.
I know what I'd like to tell them. Have the women stop and we'll get those GC to tell us the code.
They'd probably give away where we are.
Not with the DEW staring them in the face. Let me get it out of them, Mac, please. I've got to do this.
Chloe, pull it over, Mac said.
Right now?
Right now.
We okay?
Temporarily.
Mac's phone chirped. Chang. Stefanich and Plato and a bunch of GC are looking for the truck and the two GC squads. They're heading west.
Let's make this quick, Mac said, jumping out as Chloe emerged and Hannah pulled up behind.
Pop that trunk, Chloe, George said. And Hannah, let me have the DEW.
Chloe opened the trunk and Mac shone a flashlight in on the nearly wasted peacekeeper.
George pulled him from the trunk with one hand, and he lay crying on the ground.
Blisters, he sobbed. Careful, please, or kill me.
You'd like that, wouldn't you? George said, wielding the DEW. See this?
The man opened one eye and nodded miserably. This is what cooks your flesh, and there's plenty more juice in it.
Please, no.
George turned it on, and the thing whirred to life.
Please.
He aimed it at the man's ankle, and the man stiffened, whining.
Give me your all-clear code.
What?
You heard me. Give me the all-clear, or...
It's in the glove box, in my book.
Chloe went to check. She brought back a small black leather ring binder.
It's full of all kinds of notes, she said.
George took it and dropped it onto the man.
We've got to get rolling, Mac said. They're never going to buy the all-clear from us now anyway. They're on their way.
These guys are dead weight, George said. Maybe we can slow the others by leaving them here in the road. The man was ripping through the pages. He gingerly held the notebook up to the light from the truck's headlamp.
It's 11648, he said.
George dragged him onto the road while Mac brought the other from the other car. The men lay writhing.
Just kill us,
the second one pleaded.
You don't know what you're asking, George said. Bad as this is, trust me, you should prefer it.
Leave one of the cars here, Mac said. Block the road with it and the truck. It won't take the GC long to get around them, but any slowdown has to help. Chloe maneuvered one car nose-to-nose with the truck across the highway. Then they ripped out the distributor caps from both vehicles and took the keys.
"Last call for clear code," the radio said. Mac hollered it into the mic, then... "Chloe, you drive, and keep it to the floor. I'll ride shotgun. I don't expect them to catch us now, but everybody stay armed and ready."
George put the DEW in the trunk and climbed into the back with Hannah. The economy car was too small for the four of them and seemed to groan with the weight, but Chloe soon had the thing chugging along at over 70 miles an hour. George said,
"So, Mac, what's Psalm 94:1?
Mac turned as far as he could in the seat.
"Oh God," he said, "to whom vengeance belongs, shine forth."
The GC radio came to life again.
"We need an immediate 1020. Personnel on the North Road report zero traffic and no sign of you."
"Give me that," George said, pulling it from Mac's hand. He mashed the button.
"Yeah, you'll find us at Psalm 94:1.
Chang fixed himself some tea, adding a strange concoction that included instant coffee with the highest concentration of caffeine he could find. He would crash when this ordeal was over, but he couldn't risk dozing now. It was clear the Greek GC had a bead on his people, and it wouldn't be long before they figured out Mac must have a plane at the abandoned strip not 20 minutes more up the road. He certainly wasn't going to escape into Albania. How long would it take Mac and his people to board, and how far could they get before needing to refuel? Meanwhile, from what Chang could hear, Carpathia was at least entertained, if not totally distracted, by feeds from his regions where it was still daytime. The potentate for Region Zero, the United South American States, announced an event he said his wife, the First Lady, was personally attending right then.
"And where are you while she is doing your work?" Carpathia asked. "Oh, my revered Risen One, you may rest assured that I am doing the greater work. We have taken you at your word regarding the effort to root out infidels here, and I am working closely with our peacekeepers and morale monitors, as well as with civilian undercover groups. We expect to have dozens more face the guillotine or take your mark within 24 hours.
"Dozens? My dear friend, we are hearing from your compatriots around the world that some are finding hundreds, even thousands, who will suffer for their disloyalty. Some are stepping up efforts even in our part of the world in the dark of night."
The South American sighed.
"Sir, sadly, we are so dependent on the seas that our forces have been dramatically reduced. But surely so have your dissidents, have they not?"
"That is true.
But please allow me to take you live to Uruguay, where my wife attends the public ceremony culminating in loyalty enforcement."
Chang switched quickly to Mac and his crew, nothing new, then tapped into the video feed from the United South American States. The First Lady was receiving enthusiastic applause. She had her arm around a shy-looking middle-aged man.
"This gentleman is finally getting his mark of loyalty to our risen potentate."
More cheering.
"And tell us, Andres, what took you so long?"
"I was afraid," he said, smiling.
"Afraid of what?"
"The needle."
Many laughed and cheered.
"But you will do it today?"
"A very small zero, yes," he said.
"You are no longer afraid of the needle?"
"Yes, I am still, but I fear the blade more."
The crowd cheered and continued to applaud as Andres sat stiffly for the application of the mark. His forehead was swabbed, someone held his hand, the machine was applied, and he looked genuinely relieved and happy. The First Lady said,
"You may now return to what you were doing when you were discovered without the mark."
The camera followed Andres as he ran back to the image of Carpathia and fell to his knees before it. The First Lady told the crowd,
"Andres avoided detection for so long because he obeyed the decree to worship the image, and no one suspected."
Carpathia did not seem impressed.
"He worships me, and yet he is afraid of a little pinprick? Ah!" But you will be most pleased, Potentate, the South American leader said. Following the leads of several loyal citizens, we have uncovered a den of opposition. 6 were killed when they resisted arrest, but 13 have been brought to this worship and enforcement center. How many will take the mark now? Carpathia said. How many have had their attitudes adjusted by the very presence of the loyalty enforcement facilitator?
Well, actually none so far, sir.
Chang heard a fist slam.
Stubborn, Carpathia said. So stubborn. Why are these people so resolute? So stupid? So short-sighted?
Today they will pay, Highness. Right now, even as we speak, Carpathia's voice evidenced his excitement. Yes, right now.
What is the music?
The condemned ones hum and sing, my lord. It is not uncommon.
Shut them up!
One moment, excuse me, sir. He called to someone in the background.
Jorge, communicate to the officers at the site that the Supreme Potentate does not allow the music. Yes, now, Your Highness, it will be stopped.
These have definitely chosen the blade.
They have, sir. They are in line.
What are we waiting for?
Only to carry out your wish to stop the music, sir.
Get on with it. The blade will silence them.
Chang recoiled when he saw a guard with a huge rifle and bayonet nudging the first person in line, a woman who appeared to be in her late 20s. She was singing, her face turned toward heaven. The guard yelled at her, but she did not acknowledge. He bumped her and she stumbled, but she still sang, eyes upward. He jabbed her in the ribs with the butt of the rifle, and she dropped to one knee, then rose and continued singing. Now he set himself to her side, planted his feet, and drove the bayonet through her arm and into her side. She cried out as the bayonet was removed, and she reached with her other hand to press it over the wound. Her singing now came in sobs as the people behind her fell to their knees.
"What is she singing?" Carpathia demanded.
The sound was enhanced, and Chang found himself breathless as he listened to the woman's pitiful, labored singing. She could no longer hold up her head, but she stood wobbling, clearly woozy, struggling to sing.
Did e'er such love and sorrow meet, or thorns compose so rich a crown?
The guard was joined by others, swinging the stocks of their rifles at the heads of those who bowed.
Tell the guards to stop making a spectacle of it,
Carpathia raged.
They are playing right into these people's hands. Let the people see that no matter what they do or say or sing, still their heads belong to us.
The guillotine was readied as the woman continued to force out the lyrics, though she had long since lost the tune. As she was grabbed by guards on each side and wrestled into place, she cried out,
"Demands my soul, my life, my all."
The blade dropped, and the crowd erupted.
Ah! Carpathia sighed. Can we not see from the other side?
The other side, sir?
The South American potentate repeated.
Of the blade! Of the blade! Get a camera around there! The body does not drop! It merely collapses! I want to see the head drop!
The next several in line approached the killing machine with their palms raised. The guards kept grabbing their elbows and pulling down their arms, but the condemned kept raising them. The guards slashed at their hands with bayonets, but the people instinctively moved and mostly avoided being cut. The guards moved in behind them and prodded them with bayonet points in their lower back. Now the camera moved around behind a man who held the safety lever with one hand and used the other to grab the hair of the victim and pull the head into place. He lowered the restraining bar onto the neck, let go of the lever, and nodded to a matronly woman. She yanked at the release cord. The blade squealed against the guides as it dropped in a flash, and the head fell out of sight, blood erupting from the neck.
"That is more like it," Carpathia whispered.
"We're home free, aren't we?" Hannah said.
Mac turned to look at her. "My plane has about enough fuel to get us to Rome.
There's a small airstrip south of there manned by co-op people who stockpile fuel. I'm not going to feel safe until we take off from there.
But these people, I mean, she said. They'll never reach this airport before we do, will they?
Not in cars.
What are you saying? George said.
It won't take them long to guess where we're going. They won't think we're trying to beat them to the border by car.
Your plane hidden?
From auto traffic, sure. From the air, no.
How long would it take them to fly here?
Out of Kozani, in a fighter, they could beat us there.
Could they destroy your plane?
Only if they get there first.
How much personnel could they bring?
Not many if they use a small, quick plane.
George sounded irritated.
This has been too much work to see it fail now, Mac. Let's get it all on the table. You hoping we just show up, climb aboard, and take off?
That's the only plan I've got, Mac said.
We've got to figure they'll beat us there, George said, and decide what to do about that.
You want to assume the worst?
Of course, we have to. You think I got away from these idiots by hoping they'd let me go? Tell me about this airstrip.
Runs east and west. I'm at the east end, facing west.
If they can get a plane in there before we take off, all they have to do is get in our way.
Let's get in their way first, Mac said. I'll dump you guys at the plane. You get the engines warm while I drive out onto the runway and sit directly in our path. They're gonna have to be pretty crafty and flexible to avoid hitting me on landing. When we take off, we angle enough to miss the car and them, and we're gone.
George shook his head. And when do you board? You're leaving a lot to chance.
Leaving it to God, George. I don't know what else to do.
Mac's phone buzzed.
Go, Chang.
They're in a jet 10 minutes from touchdown. Stefanich, the three philosophers, and a pilot. Plane does not appear to be offensively equipped, but they are heavily armed.
We're closer than that, Mac said. We just have to beat them, that's all.
He asked Chloe if she could get any more out of the little car, but it was whining as it was, speeding along on a bad road.
When we get there, get off the road and come in on the east end.
Mac was giving Sebastian instructions about the plane when he thought he heard the scream of jet engines in the distance. He and George rolled down their windows to listen.
That's our clearing, Chloe. Easy.
She whipped off the road, down into a ravine, and up the other side. The car bounced and jerked, and Mac's head hit the ceiling.
Use your brights. I have no idea what's out here.
Am I going to be able to get through those trees? She said.
Assume you will. Just get us there.
Chloe hit a rocky patch that threw the car into the air. When it landed, the left rear tire blew.
Great, she said.
At least it's in the back, George said. Stand on it. With the brights on, Chloe saw only uneven, rocky terrain up to a thick grove of trees. She couldn't imagine a way through, but there was no turning back now. The left rear side was dragging from the flat as if someone had dropped an anchor. It didn't help that Sebastian, the biggest person in the car, sat back there. With the jet looming, Chloe wished she could kill the lights and just plow on through, but it had all come down to timing and determination. These were the people who had killed their comrades and who would now snuff out this little surviving band of Trib forces without a thought. Chloe had wanted action, to be in the thick of it, and though she would do whatever it took to get back to Buck and Kenny, she was already long past any option but recklessness. Caution, diplomacy, trickery, that was all out the window now. She had to get to that plane and they had to take off, or none of them would see the sun rise again. She picked her way through the trees, only occasionally lifting her foot from the accelerator. The little car had front-wheel drive, a small blessing in a bad situation. Making her own path, she smacked the car against a tree, first on one side, then the other, and kept going. Now she could see Mac's plane, but a three-wire fence was in the way. Slowing even a bit could make the car get tangled in it. She glanced at Mac, who braced himself with a palm on the ceiling. He merely nodded at the fence as if she had no choice. Chloe kept the accelerator down, and the car caught the lower wire, made the top two slip over the hood, pulled the wood post from the ground, and snapped its way through to the edge of the runway, 40 feet from the plane.
Banking at the other end came the GC jet, landing lights illuminating the strip all the way to the car.
Chapter 12. For the first time since he had been running the point for the Tribulation Force at the Palace Complex, Chang wondered if he had been found out. His computer screen was suddenly ringed with a red border, meaning an outside source was testing his firewall. He immediately switched to a screensaver that scrolled the date and time and temperature, cut all the lights in his apartment, disrobed and jumped into bed, prepared to look as if he had been sleeping, should Figueroa or one of his minions come knocking. There was really no way of knowing what the warning meant, but David Hasid had told him he had built the security in just to alert the operator that someone was nosing around. Maybe someone was checking to see every computer that was turned on. Who knew whether the search was capable of hacking in and finding out who the mole was? The latter didn't seem possible, if David could be believed. He had rigged the system so elaborately that it seemed there wouldn't be enough years left before the glorious appearing before someone could decode it. Chang's mind began playing games. Perhaps Akbar had instructed Figueroa to sense every computer running, eliminate the mainframe that ran the whole place, isolate the laptops and personal computers, and do a fast door-to-door search to see what people were up to. Chang's computer would show no record of what he had been doing during the hours since he got back from his office. For that reason, he hoped someone would show up and check. As he lay there in the darkness, heart galloping, Chang was frustrated at having to quit monitoring Greece. Ironic, he thought, that with all the technology God had allowed them to adapt for the cause of Christ around the world, he was suddenly left with nothing to do to help except old-fashioned praying. He wished he could check the bugs in Carpathia's and Akbar's offices once more to see if the computer recording showed them giving a directive. It wouldn't be long before someone at the highest level ran out of patience with all the hacking going on. Chang eased out of bed and onto the cold floor, kneeling to pray for Mac and Chloe and Hannah and George. "Lord, I don't see how they can escape now, outside your direct help. I don't know if it's their time to join you, and I have never assumed our thoughts were your thoughts. Everything happens in your time for your pleasure. But I pray for them and the people who love them. Whatever you do, I know will prove your greatness, and I ask that I be able to know soon what it was. Also, please be with Ming as she searches for our parents, and may they be able to communicate with me somehow." Chang felt the urge to let Rayford know what was going on. He looked at his watch. It was well after midnight, but would the people in Petra be sleeping after all that had gone on there that day? Nothing indicated that his phone was not still secure, so he dialed. "Out, out!" Mac hollered as the doors flew open. "Let me over there, Chloe. I've got to get in the way of that jet." "I'll crank her up," Sebastian told Mac, "but I'm not inclined to leave without you." "Listen, George, you do what you have to do. Worrying about me might distract them long enough for you to get in the air. If that's what it takes, I'll see you at the Eastern Gate." "Don't talk like that. Don't get emotional on me now. Get yourselves on home." Mac waited a beat for George to back away from the car, and when he didn't, Mac just floored it and wobbled down the runway in line with the jet that was just about to touch down. Rayford was not asleep, but he had finally settled and was breathing easier, gazing at the stars through a slit in the tent. His phone indicated Chang was calling. "Give me good news," he said. "I wish I could," Chang said, "but I think the Lord just wanted me to let you know so you could pray." Rayford didn't feel as glib as he sounded, but when he heard the story, he said, "God protected 1 million people in a fiery furnace. He can get 4 out of Greece." He slipped on his sandals and hurried to where Zion and Chaim were to bed down. If they were sleeping, he wouldn't wake them. It didn't surprise him to find them awake and huddled around a computer with some of the other elders. At the keyboard was the young woman Naomi, who had summoned him earlier. "Zion, a word," Rayford said. Dr. Ben-Judah turned, surprised.
I thought you were sleeping, as we all should be. Big day tomorrow.
Rayford brought him up to date.
We will pray, of course, right now. But get back to Chang and tell him the computer warning was a false alarm. Naomi has been exulting in the hundreds of pages of instructions David built into the system here, including one that allows us to check the palace computers. That is what she has been doing, and that sent Chang's computer a warning.
Zion hurried back to the elders and asked them all to pray for the safety of the Tribulation Force contingent in Greece. To see a dozen and a half people immediately go to their knees for his people warmed Rayford, and he couldn't wait to get back to Chang. When George Sebastian's foot hit the first step up to the plane, he heard the engines whine and then scream to life. He hadn't realized either of the women knew how to fly. So much the better. He squatted to pull the door up behind him, but when he turned toward the cockpit, he noticed both Chloe and Hannah strapping themselves into the back two seats. They looked as surprised as he felt. George set his Uzi and pressed his back up against the bulkhead that separated the cabin from the cockpit. He slowly edged around to where he could peer up front to see who was there. The surprise pilot, in brown and beige Bedouin-type robes, was working from the co-pilot's chair. Without turning, the man raised a hand and motioned George toward the pilot's chair. George pulled back and faced the women.
"Who is that?"
"We thought it was you," Chloe said.
"We've got to get him off here, or we won't have room for Mac. Cover me."
Chloe unstrapped and knelt behind George with her Uzi ready. Hannah raised her weapon and stood on the arm of her seat so she could peer over George's head into the cockpit. Sebastian hopped into view of the co-pilot's chair. Empty.
"All righty then," George said, exhaling loudly and climbing over the back of the seat to take the controls. He jammed on the earphones. "Why doesn't God just let these guys do the flying?"
"I can do that too," a voice said.
George jumped and saw the reflection of the man in the windshield, but when he looked to his right, the co-pilot's chair was still empty.
"Quit that," George said, his pulse racing.
"Sorry."
"Michael, I suppose."
"Roger."
George saw Mac and the rattling GC car struggling down the runway in the face of the oncoming jet. He wanted to ask Michael if he wouldn't be more help riding next to Mac.
"Illuminate landing lights," he heard.
"For takeoff?"
"Roger."
Sebastian wasn't about to argue. He flipped on the landing lights, which merely shone into Mac's back window.
"Should I start the taxi angling away from Mac like he said?"
"Stand by."
"No?
Hold."
For an instant, Mac thought the GC jet didn't see him. He slammed on the brakes and stayed in line between the two craft. When the jet finally stopped, about 50 feet in front of him, he realized it could easily go around him. Why wasn't Sebastian rolling? With the right angle, he could get past Mac and the GC and be in the air in seconds. Not wanting to give the GC a chance to cut George off, Mac hit the accelerator and pulled to within 10 feet of the jet. He realized someone could open the door and have a clear shot at him, but they couldn't do much to his plane if he sabotaged their aircraft. Not wanting to give them time to think, he raced forward and lodged the front of the car under the nose of the jet, banging into the landing gear. He had raised the plane off the ground a few inches, but couldn't tell if he had done any damage. Mac rolled down his window and leaned his torso all the way out, firing his Uzi at the tires. He was amazed how resilient they were, and he heard bullets bouncing off and hitting the fuselage and the car. Reaching farther and experimenting with angles, he finally got one of the tires to blow. But where was George? Why weren't they advancing? Was something wrong with the plane? Sebastian just sat at the end of the runway with those lights on. Mac expected the GC to come bounding out any second, weapons blazing. Could they not see he was the only person in the car? What were they afraid of? He was a sitting duck lodged under their jet. Mac tried to open the door, found it hopelessly stuck, and tried getting out the other side. It, too, was out of shape and not moving, but he thought he sensed a little more give on that side.
He lay in the front seat and pushed with his hands on the driver's side door while pressing against the passenger door with his feet. It finally broke free and he scrambled out. He crouched beneath the jet, Uzi trained on the door. He would take them as they came out if they dared. Maybe they were waiting for him to make a break for his own plane or for Sebastian to come and pick him up. But opening the door for him would slow George, too, and all of them would be in danger. As he waited, locked in a bewildering standoff, Mac didn't know what to do. Should he try to shoot through the skin of the jet and take them all out? If it was armor-plated, which was likely, he would waste ammunition. Why weren't they coming after him, and why was George still waiting? The GC jet shut down. Now what? Nothing. No movement inside or out. Frustrated, Mac grabbed his walkie-talkie.
"Chloe or Hannah?" he whispered desperately. "Come in, please."
"Chloe here, Mac."
"What's going on?"
"Got me. George is at the controls."
"What's he doing?"
"You want to talk to him? Here." "Kinda busy here, Mac. What's up?"
"You can see what's up. What are you doing?"
"Waiting for clearance."
"You're clear. Go. Go now. Angle to your right."
"These guys are hung up and I've got one of their tires blown. They've shut down their engines." "Waiting for you, partner."
"Don't be silly. I'd run right into their line of fire. Go to the other end of the runway and I'll meet you there. But if they come after me, just keep going."
"Yeah, I know, and you'll see me in heaven."
"Exactly. Now quit being stupid and go."
"I'm not being stupid, Mac. I'm obeying."
"You're supposed to obey me, so do as I say."
"Sorry, you've been superseded."
"What?"
"You're supposed to put down your weapon and walk this way."
"You got GC on that plane?"
"Negative. Come unarmed and you will be safe."
"Have you lost your mind?"
"God is telling you to come." Mac shook his head.
Stand by.
Come now." Mac sighed, his eyes darting back and forth between the jet door and his own plane. He pushed the transmit button.
"Lord, if it is you, command me to come that way."
"Come." The voice had not been George's.
"Unarmed?"
"Come." Mac waited a beat, then unstrapped the Uzi and lay it on the ground. He turned off the walkie-talkie and jammed it into his pocket. He walked past the car and stood directly under the cockpit. He felt exposed, vulnerable, indefensible. If that jet door opened now, he was a dead man. He heard nothing above him, saw nothing beside him. Mac stepped out from under the plane and headed directly in front of it. He kept imagining he heard movement behind him, the engines roaring to life, footsteps from the cabin to the door opening, weapons firing. He prayed urgently as he strode along, "Lord, save me." Immediately he felt as if God's hands were upon him, and he barely felt his feet on the ground. "Oh, you of little faith, why do you doubt?" The voice was clear as crystal, but the walkie-talkie was off, and George had his engines roaring. Mac broke into a trot, then a run. Every step sounded like a gunshot. Hannah was lowering the door when he got there, and he leaped in.
"Flying or backseat driving?"
George said, unstrapping as if ready to take the co-pilot's chair.
"Here is fine," Mac said. "I don't think I could ride a bike right now."
Chang was relieved to hear from Rayford and eager to meet Naomi, even if only online. He was tempted to scold her for scaring him, and so decided to wait until the next day to try to make contact. Meanwhile, he checked in on Mac and his team, fearing the worst despite all the praying that had been going on. Mac answered his phone, sounding exhausted.
"I need to meet this Michael someday," Chang said, after hearing the story. "You guys get all the fun."
"I could use a little less fun, frankly," Mac said. "And you might as well know, Sebastian here doesn't call him Michael anymore. Calls him Roger."
"Roger?"
"Says he told him he assumed he was Michael, and the guy said Roger."
"So Stefanich and those guys are just sitting on the runway with a wounded plane?"
"Yeah, and they're gonna need some repair work before they can take off again."
Why didn't they shoot you? I thought you could find out. What was going on in that cockpit when I strolled out from underneath, unarmed? I'll let you know.
Within half an hour, the rest of the Tribulation Force had heard the good news out of Greece, and Chang had paved the way for George to land south of Rome for the refuel. They were on their own for getting back to the safe house without going through Kankakee, Illinois, and without arousing more suspicion. That should be the easiest part of their ordeal. When Chang was finally able to hack back into the Ptolemaeus GC system and find transmissions between the plane and the Kozani Tower, he could only shake his head. The pilot had reported seeing the plane at the end of the runway, putting down and seeing a car approaching. But at the same time, Chang figured Michael had instructed George to turn on his landing lights. The pilot reported a light so blinding that, "We have lost visual contact with the plane and the auto." A few minutes later, the pilot reported being struck by what he didn't know. His jet was being jostled and the front end lifted, but no one aboard could take his hands from his eyes because of the intense light. They heard shooting and feared for their lives, heard one of their tires blow and shut down the engines. In essence, they sat in fear, unable to peek out of the cockpit for the next several minutes until they heard the plane thunder past them and rise. Chang listened as they finally ventured out, shoulder radios left on, weapons ordered at the ready, only to find their damaged plane, wounded landing gear, flat tire, beat-up squad car, and an Uzi on the runway. Only now they were being rescued by a fleet of GC in cars who reported that others had picked up the injured officers at the side of the road on the way. They were being treated for severe burns they claimed were caused by a ray gun. It was still a couple of hours before Ming was to leave San Diego for the Far East. Chang was finally finished with his night's work. He dropped into bed, spent. How strange, he thought, to feel so pivotal and indispensable, and then discover that the entire success of an operation was out of his hands. In fact, he had been out of commission when God worked his miracles. There were victims to grieve, martyrs to praise, and much work ahead. Chang didn't know how long he could evade detection. He was willing to hang in and work in the office during the day, doing his real work after hours, for as long as God chose to protect him. Rayford stirred at dawn's first light, amazed he had been able to sleep at all. Petra was already humming, families gathering the morning's manna and filling any container they could find with the pure spring water God provided. Thousands were working on the caves, thousands of others erecting more tents. On everyone's lips were stories of the miracle from the day before and the promise of live teaching from Dr. Zion ben Judah himself later in the day. From the elders and organizers came word that building materials were on their way and that the people should pray for the safety of pilots and truckers who would begin delivering materials. Volunteers were sought with expertise in various crafts. Rayford knew the current spirit couldn't last forever. The memory of the miracle would fade inevitably, though he couldn't imagine it. And people, regardless of their shared faith, would find living elbow to elbow taxing after a while. But for now, he would enjoy this. Rayford would have to get back to the Tribulation Force at some point, but Carpathia's people would target anyone coming or going from Petra. Perhaps if the supplies were able to get in, that would be a clue it was prudent to try to get out. Naomi and her team of computer gurus already reported that the Truth Cyberzine had been transmitted from Buck Williams, recounting stories from around the world. The whole episode of what had gone on in Greece the day before was played out in detail, as was the truth about what had happened at Petra. A team of computer experts from Israel said they had the technology to project the truth onto a giant screen if one could be fashioned, and among the various supplies already in the camp was enough white canvas to be stretched several stories high. Thousands gathered to read the stories. Rayford loved the idea that it was not just believers, not just the so-called Judahites who read the truth. Many undecideds, and even some who had taken the mark of Antichrist, risked their lives by downloading Buck's magazine from the Tribulation Force site. All over the world, the Believers Underground and co-op personnel translated it and printed it and distributed it. Carpathia could get away with nothing. Sadly, Rayford knew, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of uncommitted people right there in Petra. Zion had already promised to address them, too, going so far as to say many of them would still be deceived and eventually spirited away by liars and charlatans. It was hard to understand or believe. How could someone have survived what Rayford had lived through and even questioned the one true God of the universe? It was beyond him. Late in the morning, nearly 24 hours since the bombing, the people began to gather. Word spread that Dr. Ben Judah would begin his teaching on the mercy of God. Throughout the crowd, however, stories also spread from around the world that persecution had intensified against believers, and particularly against Jews. Chang had tapped into the feeds to Akbar's and Fortunato's and Carpathia's offices, and had set on automatic the utility that sent to Buck Williams's computer the reports from the subpotentates around the world. As the sun rose in various countries, the bloodshed and mayhem of the night before and the relentless daytime raids were transmitted not just to New Babylon, but also from Chang to Buck and from Buck to the world through the truth. As the crowds gathered to hear Dr. Ben Judah, they were riveted to the giant screen set on a wall away from the sun for best viewing. Buck had transmitted the visuals Chang had sent him from the United South American states, and the masses booed and hissed as the shy man accepted the mark of loyalty. They cheered, then wept, then sang and praised God for the testimony of the brave martyrs who faced the blade with such peace and courage. The remnant at Petra seemed outraged en masse at the reports from Greece about a midnight raid that had destroyed what was left of the small contingent of underground believers. Buck had added audio to that video report, reminding his readers and listeners and watchers that it had fallen to Greek believers to be among the first to give their lives rather than accept the mark of the beast. Now, it seemed, on every continent, the morale monitors and the peacekeepers had been revitalized, financed, equipped, and motivated to more than turn up the heat. From every corner of the globe came reports of the end of the patience of the global community for dissenters or even the undecided. It was either accept the mark now or face the consequences immediately. Even many who had already taken the mark of Carpathia were punished for not bowing to worship his image 3 times a day. Leon Fortunato came on, in full regalia and introduced by every title and pedigree he had ever enjoyed, to warn that those of Jewish descent who are as stubborn as the Judites and insist on worshiping a god other than our father and risen Lord Nikolai Carpathia shall find themselves receiving their just reward. Yea, death is too good for them. Oh, they shall surely die, but it is hereby decreed that no Jew should be allowed the mercy of a quick end by the blade. Graphic and reproachful as that is, it is virtually painless. No, these shall suffer day and night in their dens of iniquity, and by the time they expire due to natural causes, brought about by their own rejection of Carpathianism, they will be praying, crying out for a death so expedient as the loyalty enforcement facilitator. Those in Petra appeared to Rayford shocked by the lengths New Babylon would go to take revenge on its enemies and humiliate Jews. But their greatest wrath and derision were saved for the report from GCNN about what had happened the day before, right there in the Red Rock City. An anchorman intoned that the attack on Petra, 2 incendiary bombs and a land-based launch missile, had missed its target, and that the enemy encamped there had swiftly struck back and downed the 2 fighter bombers, killing the pilots. The laughter began with that report and turned to waved fists and hisses and boos as Carpathia came on to mourn the deaths of the martyred airmen.
While there is no denying that it was pilot error, still the global community, I am sure, joins me in extending its deepest sympathy to the surviving families. We decided not to risk any more personnel in trying to destroy this stronghold of the enemy, but we will starve them out by cutting off supply lines. Within days, this will be the largest Jewish concentration camp in history, and their foolish stubbornness will have caught up with them. Fellow citizens of the New World Order, my compatriots in the global community, we have these people and their leaders to thank for the tragedy that besets our seas and oceans. I have been repeatedly urged by my closest advisors to negotiate with these international terrorists, these purveyors of black magic who have used their wicked spells to cause such devastation. I am sure you agree with me that there is no future in such diplomacy. I have nothing to offer in exchange for the millions of human lives lost, not to mention the beauty and the richness of the plant and animal life. You may rest assured that my top people are at work to devise a remedy to this tragedy, but it will not include deals, concessions, or any acknowledgement that these people had the right to foist on the world such an unspeakable act. In the middle of that newscast, from Chang through Bach, came a reproduction.